What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Matt Robeson, Beyond Politics, and you may have heard about the crisis facing media organizations, plummeting revenue, layoffs, bankruptcies. But what you may not have heard is that actually, left-leaning and mainstream news isn't doing nearly as badly as right-wing media. And in fact, it's the outlets that cater to the right-wing that are facing by far the biggest declines. In the words of today's guest, the journalist Paul Farhi, who was the longtime media reporter for The Washington Post, now writing for The Atlantic, and he just wrote a fascinating piece about this that went viral, that traffic to the right wing is utterly collapsing. So how big is this effect? Why is it happening? And is it really good news for the anti-Trump world, or is the situation a little bit more complicated? Hint, it's a mix. There's a lot going on under the surface. We got into that later in the discussion. There's some really good news and some not so good news. But I started in with Paul right at the beginning, right at the headline, and trying to understand what's actually going on right now. Paul, when you wrote that the flow of traffic to Donald Trump's most loyal digital media boosters isn't just slowing, it's utterly collapsing. What did you mean by that? How bad is it getting?
Very bad. It depends where you look and what your standard of comparison is. So if you compare it to 2020, it looks catastrophic. If you compare it, more importantly, to last year, where in fact there weren't a whole lot of news events, the campaign was starting up and everything, it looks really bad. So you take your pick, catastrophic or really bad, but the direction in both cases is downward and south. I can read you off some statistics for various websites. For instance, the top 10 conservative, right-wing, whichever term you want to use, websites have lost 40% collectively since 2020.
Wow.
And within that number, things like The Daily Caller losing 57%, Drudge, if you want to call Drudge a conservative website aggregator, Drudge is down 81%. And then The Federalist, this blew my mind, The Federalist, which is about 10 or 12 years old, has lost 91% of its traffic. Now, I don't know how anyone survives losing 91% of their customers, but there you are, 91. And you look at the biggest of the conservative websites, and that's
Fox. Oh, you're going to say the F word, aren't you?
Yes. The biggest one is FoxNews.com because it works in concert with the TV channel, self-promotion and in a loop. They haven't been as badly hit. You look at the number since 2020, it's down 22%. Doesn't sound that bad, except within that number, because Fox News was so enormous, they've lost 23 million actual people. 23 million more people came in 2020 to their website than are coming now as of February, when the data is the last time we have data on them. So the point, the trend is very much down, and point of the article was to try and understand exactly what. Everybody, including the mainstream media, whatever that is these days, is also down, but not nearly at the level that the conservative media is. They are far harder hit by this than the Washington Post, the New York Times, you name it. And what's going on with them? And there's a bunch of different explanations. We can get into it now.
Yeah, no, I wanted to ask you. You provide in the article what doctors would call a differential diagnosis. Here are the possibilities and the probabilities attached to each of them. But you gave an interesting kind of main hypothesis that's attached to social media. I thought that was compelling.
Yes. And that, I think, is the main event here, the main cause and explanation of it, is that these websites, Gateway Pundit, Breitbart, Daily Caller, Daily Wire, were absolutely dependent on Facebook as a referral system. Google to a lesser extent, but Google as well. And by that, it means that Facebook serves up, by their mysterious algorithms, a link to Ben Shapiro on Daily Wire it gets clicks. You're off, you go from Facebook to the Daily Wire and Ben Shapiro. You get something outrageous out of Breitbart, off you go. Gateway Pundit, same thing. And that this worked as an ecosystem up through really about 2020, where Facebook would be just a referral machine for these websites. Facebook, having had a lot of criticism that it was feeding people more or less harmful information, misinformation, disinformation, including Russian propaganda, in 2018 did something very significant. It downplayed in its algorithms. Again, we don't know what those algorithms actually do, secret sauce by Facebook. They adjusted those algorithms so you weren't being fed the same kind of news and the same kind of commentary that had automatically come into your feed all the time, and that they had boosted instead, not eliminated the news and commentary, but boosted instead the friends and family stuff. I got a new cat, I got a new dog, my niece just got married. That kind of stuff was given priority in the algorithms to the kind of extreme opinion that was often served up. So the effect of this is a gradual decline in referrals off of Facebook. Now, Facebook doesn't really produce any news of its own, but it's the most important facilitator, broker, I don't know what you would call it, of the internet and the way in which news gets disseminated and distributed to people and the way people get news. This change in the algorithms disproportionately harmed these particular websites. It harmed everybody to a certain extent, fewer referrals, but the extreme stuff, the conservative right-wing gateway pundit InfoWars stuff, was downgraded in referrals. And the effect is what we're seeing now, this, again, get gradual and precipitous decline in traffic for those websites. And that's where we're at.
I want to avoid wish casting here, but I can't help having a certain amount of, I bring my priors to this. Like most of the audience here, I'm center left leaning, like I suspect the majority of my audience is. And so I have a little bit of a hope here. My first hope would be that you're going to tell me the problem here is that Ben Shapiro is going to prison. That would be my dream scenario. More realistic, let me run this piece of the differential diagnosis by you. Is it possible? I might be wish casting, but is it possible that people on the right are just more exhausted by the outrage machine because it's been operating in overdrive for years now? And it's been well documented that Trump and his aligned forces may have been exhausting their grassroots. Look no further than the data on the massive decline in small dollar donations for Trump. In 2020, Trump and his committees raised a record $626.6 million from small dollar donors. That's defined as 200 aggregate donations or less. But last year, Trump raised just $51 million from small donors. And that's way down. I'm throwing too many numbers at people, but that's obviously way, way down. Is it possible that they're just, people are just tapping out?
I love the fact that you have this connected theory of the universe, but I don't actually see what you're seeing in this. That the media's effect on political contributions is a very uncertain connection. We don't really know how that works. I'm sure it's been studied by political scientists, but we don't really know. I do think there is exhaustion in terms of give and give. People run out of money and they run out of enthusiasm. But let me just take the part I think I know best, which is the media thing. The fact that these right-wing conservative websites have seen their traffic fall so substantially is not the phenomenon that you're getting to, which is somehow a loss of enthusiasm on the right. That's not really the conclusion you should draw. The conclusion I draw from this is that there are alternatives for people to go to. They can get the same kind of stuff they got from Breitbart on YouTube. They can get it on Rumble. They can get it on Truth Social. They can get it on Substack. There's a million ways now, podcasts, obviously. There's a million ways for people of an ideological bent to get their feed, to get their fix. And how that actually translates into giving to a candidate, again, that's a black box I won't get into. But again, up through 2020, there was less of a substantial Substack podcast. There's a lot of different alternatives now, is my point. And so it has fragmented the audience. It's like looking at the Nielsen ratings. Go back 50 years and boy, look at MASH getting 100 million viewers for its finale. Nothing gets 100 million for a finale because there are so many alternatives. And it's the same way in conservative media. There's just a zillion alternatives. People can go different ways. The thing that built these websites into what seemed to be a force of politics has really undermined them now. And that's why they are less of a force.
Interesting. So the issue, your diagnosis is, it's not about demand. It's much more about distribution. And
that's right.
What you're seeing is a media phenomenon, like just to apples it with news content. 1980, the evening news broadcasts on the three major channels, 45 million viewers a night. 40 years later, down to 22, 23 million viewers,
that's
sort of
right.
Cut in half. And that's right. The kind of fracturing. I want to talk fracturing. I do. Before we get to that, because, boy, there's so many rabbit holes we can go down with fracturing. I just want to hold that off for 1 second. Yep. You spent a long time at the Washington Post. So I want to follow on the heels of some of your Washington Post predecessors. Let's follow the money for just a second here. What could you make out in reporting out this story about the financial impact? Obviously, like I said, I'd love for the answer to be, well, Ben Shapiro is going to go bankrupt and be shipped into outer space.
Yeah,
it'd be terrible. But it seems like there's some pushback to that. They might be doing okay.
Let's back up. The Washington Post cut 10% of its staff at the end of 2023. When I say cut, offered buyouts to 10% of its staff. I was one of those people who took the buyout. Now, on my own, semi-retired. I'm not sure what I call myself. Now, point is, because of the financial climate in which all media exists, and it's not a good climate, the Post had to reduce its overhead. You could argue whether Jeff Bezos ever needs to reduce his overhead in running an operation like the Washington Post, but that's a podcast for another time.
That is a deep story.
Yeah, that is completely. But the point being is the Washington Post was a newsroom of about 1,000 journalists. That's a very big newsroom. There aren't many in America or around the world that large. The sub-segment we're talking about, the Daily Wire's Gateway Pundits on and on Breitbart, are very small operations. They have a staff of, if they have a dozen, I'd be surprised. A lot of it is done through freelance. So their overhead is not what the Washington Post overhead is. But in answer directly to your question, it's very hard to know how much this loss of traffic, this substantial loss of traffic, is really affecting them. They're all private. They're all, not all, but many of them are owned by wealthy individuals who have an agenda other than making money. You could argue that Jeff Bezos has an agenda other than making money, but I don't really see it. Nevertheless, the point is there. It's very opaque. We don't really know how badly affected they are. They're not going to announce that they're laying off staff. Their losses of whatever they are probably are being absorbed by somebody who figures, I never was in this for the money anyway. And are they wildly profitable? No, they are not. It doesn't take a lot to sustain Gateway Pundit. It's Jim Hoffman and his merry band, and they are able to get by with a relatively small staff. So again, I don't know that anybody's going bankrupt. I wouldn't be surprised if that happened here or there. The mainstream media has had its own financial problems, but the structure of the mainstream media, to my long-winded point, is very different from these smaller operations. They're effectively boutique operations that don't need a lot of revenue. And so the loss of revenue probably isn't going to put them under.
To the extent, and they claim in the article, there are some claims, we've gone to more of a subscriber model, we're making money on merch. I don't know what they're saying. Suffice it to say that you would think that a majority of their revenue would be coming from ad placements. I'm going to give you a data point. This is just for fun. Just so you know, in preparing for today's conversation, I went back and re-referenced your article. And wouldn't you know it, in the middle of your article on The Atlantic, the well-known conservative right-wing rag that it is, I got an ad placed. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. The ad is for the Tactical Concealment Shelf. I don't know if you've seen this. It is a very nice looking wood shelf. It's got a little plant sitting on it and what looks like a peace candle, or I don't know. And then that's on the left. And then on the right, it says open and ready. And you lower a secret shelf. And what's inside? Two guns, because you don't need just one. And first of all, this begs the question of what am I into? What do they think my demographics are? But the other one is, at least to some extent, the traffic that you would think they'd be sending based on search engine keywords, when you've got a lot of trigger keywords in this article here, to places like the Daily Caller, is now ending up at the Atlantic. So you've done one good thing yourself to starve the beast. All right.
You are a prepper now. Of course, that's called programmatic advertising. Atlantic has no idea what's being fed into these blank spaces that somehow you, through your search history or something, triggered. There's a cookie somewhere going out into the world.
Oh, no.
And good luck getting rid of it, because you'll probably end up seeing a lot of this once you start seeing a lot of this.
I got to click on the Tactical Concealment Shelf. It's sure. Talk about triggering. That was, I saw what you did there. I don't know. Yeah. This is triggering a lot of questions for me. Do I need a Tactical Concealment Shelf? What about in my kitchen? Do I need a Tactical Concealment Pantry? What if I release guns secretly, but they're not enough? Do I need little guns inside the guns, like the Cat in the Hat Comes Back? I don't know. Many questions.
Yeah. But this is the wonder of programmatic advertising. And if you are on the internet, you are familiar, even if you don't know the concept, it's algorithms feeding people ads based on their search history, based on what they've done before. They know a lot about you, and they know a lot about me and everybody else. And this is, there is a vast number of advertisers seeking eyeballs, whether it's appropriate or not. The one I love is when you go and make a hotel reservation, you click through and you do the thing. And then about 5 minutes later, you get another ad for a hotel. No, I just made the reservation. I don't need a hotel.
Right. Yes. There does seem to be something a little bit broken in that model. And yet, you know, to your point about fracturing and sort of the financial piece, I think those two seem to go together, because you mentioned, just by way of comparison, the overhead inherent in an operation like WAPO, 1,000 journalists, all the HR, all the stuff that goes with running a large-scale business versus not just a small-scale business, which I guess the Daily Caller and the Federalist are probably suffering, even with relatively small merry bands. But then, as you point to fracturing, what you're really pointing to, it seems, is a lot of micro operations, solo operators. My podcast, I run with a partner. I've got a YouTube channel with a partner, and we do not have a lot of overhead. And with technology, we can accomplish an awful lot and get amazed like you and put out a high quality product. I guess that this,
is a phenomenon of the last 20 years of media. You don't have to work for a large organization or even a middle-sized operation. You can take your creativity, your thoughts, and there's many outlets for them. Everybody's a creator. Everybody who owns a smartphone is a broadcaster. And that is a revolution that we've been dealing with for 20 years now. I'm saying something obvious, but there's no organizational structure necessary. And in fact, there's an argument that organizations probably are the dinosaurs here, and that we'll all be on our own at some point, producing our own podcasts and our own Substack newsletters, what have you.
That's frightening, kind of the way our whole economy became about selling each other our houses for a while. Now it'll be like, hey, would you subscribe to my Substack? I want to take a very different angle on this. Our listeners are fresh off of hopefully hearing our last interview with Sasha Eisenberg, the journalist who just wrote The Lie Detectives, which is about the realization, especially among leading Democrats, a small band of leading Democrats, that they were competing on a vastly different information landscape than they thought they had been in the wake of the 2016 election. And they set about trying to figure out, hey, how do we compete on this landscape of misinformation and disinformation mediated by technology? I'm going to make a real stretch of an analogy here, but I remember that there was a bit of a debate about going after large terrorist organizations, and that if you take out the top leadership of those terrorist organizations, what ends up happening is you have splinter cells all over the place, and they're much harder to track and they're much harder to fight in some ways. And I'm wondering, to the extent that these sites are purveyors of an awful lot of, I'm going to be slanted about this, crap, a lot of misinformation and disinformation. If what you're seeing is they're suffering because of fracturing and that traffic is going to a million points of darkness, is that making the work of the lie detectives much, much harder?
The answer is yes. And the larger answer is, what are you going to do about it? There isn't a lot of ways to shut down misinformation or even to identify or that we would agree on what constitutes misinformation and disinformation. That's what the internet has brought about, which is a million flowers or a million weeds blooming. And that's what you are stuck with. If you thought Breitbart was out on a limb, which it often is, or Gateway Pundit was out on a limb, they now look like conventional websites in a way compared to the 4chan, the more extremists out there. Just look at X. You can't be on X without seeing who knows what all. Everybody now has the power to create, and everybody has the power to be an influencer, a word that really didn't have any meaning 10 years ago, 5 years ago, who knows. So this is the genie that's out of that bottle. There's nothing we can necessarily do about it. Our mission, or so we thought at the Washington Post, and I still think it's a valid mission, is to say what's true and to say what's factual and to present information that people can rely on and that's trustworthy, that's verified. And of course, we get tons of criticism about how you didn't do your job on this or that story. But there's still got to be some center line here, because the extremes are flying off into, I'm sure you can find lots of left-wing stuff, but the phenomenon of the right-wing misinformation machine is a much larger and more complicated picture. And we saw this phenomenon during the 2006 election, where you don't even have to be a domestic individual. You can be a Russian troll factory and feed this kind of information to people. So anyway, a long-winded way of saying, I don't know what to do about it.
It's a deep problem. And I think one of the reasons why your article has driven the conversation as much as it has since it came out, and kudos to you on that. It was really sitting on that Atlantic top 10 list and a lot of discussion coming out of it. I bring it up casually to people and they say, oh yeah, I saw that one, is it presents the veneer of this is a good news story, right? And then when you really think about it, there are a lot of deep questions that come out of it. Now, you put one of the deepest questions at the very end of your article. It's literally in your last graph. I love it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to bring it up yet. I am going to tease it for our audience. I want to go down a slightly different angle on this for just a minute. The other article that has been driving a lot of the conversation is the Yuri Berliner piece, essentially accusing NPR of a massive shift in kind of their coverage, their slant to the left, alienating kind of the mainstream of America. And it feels to me like that's the other current major commentary and observation on media going on. And it's turned into a little bit of a Rorschach test for what we all think about the role of media. What was your reaction to it?
Oh, I have many reactions. First of all, I can't believe that he would do that, because you work for an organization, as he has for 25 years, you know the rules. And the rules are, you don't go off the reservation, you don't diss the organization in such a public way. There are ways in which you can express an opinion, but often it's with the approval or the oversight of your bosses. So that's first of all. I couldn't imagine having done a similar thing, but he did it, and that's his deal. I had to imagine that at the age of, I think he's 67, maybe he was at the end and he was fed up and that he was going to have at it. The next level of reaction was, I'm not sure he's proven his case. I'm not sure he has shown by the examples that he used that NPR is as liberal as he thinks it is, or doesn't have the viewpoint diversity. Now, we should talk about what he means by viewpoint diversity. if by viewpoint diversity he means we need to reflect the conservative right-wing perspective more than we do, perhaps that's a legit basis on which to critique. We should all reflect the reality of the world, whether we like it or not, whether it comports with what we believe. We are obligated to show the full extent of opinion and thought. If by viewpoint diversity he means publish garbage, publish crap, publish things that aren't true, then no, we don't have an obligation to viewpoint diversity, which becomes a very slippery phrase. I have many friends who are liberal. I have many friends who are conservative. People in the middle. I get that there is a range of opinion and a range of perspectives that people have. But as journalists, we're not obligated to present things we knowingly understand to be false. And I think that's what got a lot of conservative right-wing people to cheer this on, is that you're not properly reflecting my point of view. Yes and no is my response to that. And I thought his examples were not necessarily...
His examples were awful. Let's be clear. I will say it so you don't have to, but the example... Claiming that Mueller found no evidence of collusion, that's just factually false. That's literally taking a Donald Trump meme and giving it a patina of respectability by putting a senior NPR editor's name over the top of it. It's what we gently refer to in the profession as bullshit. That's not the case. Anyway, sorry, I'm editorializing here.
And in fact, what he cited was Bill Barr's characterization of the Mueller report. Remember when Barr stepped up, and the report itself was not released until about 4 weeks after Barr basically held a press conference and characterized it in ways that were a little bit slippery and weren't quite accurate. And so in citing that, he's citing a partisan characterization of it to validate the notion that this is what Mueller found. Mueller actually found a lot of things. And Barr's own characterization was not necessarily getting to all of them. I won't go as far as to say bullshit, but incomplete is certainly a fair characterization of what Barr did. And he did it. But I don't think this notion of viewpoint diversity got enough debate. It's like he's basically said to reduce his argument is that NPR has become so woke that it's missing the story. And my reaction to that is reflecting racial diversity, national origin diversity, sexual diversity, et cetera. Those are viewpoint diversities. In other words, because you may be part of a group, you might see the world a little bit differently than you or I or anybody else. So that is viewpoint diversity. What he means by it is we need more conservatives. Actually, NPR has a reasonably defensible position on conservatives. The thing is, you couldn't listen to NPR, and still, I don't know to what extent true, without hearing some Republican come on, because they did have some sense of obligation to presenting the other side. But Steve Inskeep, the host of Morning Edition, wrote a very good Substack essay about this. We're not obligated to tell you things that aren't true because they make you feel good. It's just not what a journalist does.
I think the biggest problem was that he conflated two different arguments. What he wanted to say is the version that you said much more clearly a moment ago, which is NPR has become too woke. And for listeners to The Gist, the Mike Pesca podcast, he has been making that case, and he has a leg to stand on as an NPR veteran. And there is a case to be made there that what they've gone for is a certain kind of view of diversity that very much reflects a very left-wing, one could say, woke view of what people want to hear. And they've created shows that are meant to appeal to a much more diverse set of audiences. And you can quibble with, is that a good business strategy? Is that a good content strategy? Is that a good news strategy? That is one viewpoint. It's debatable. It's interesting. We could talk about that. What he conflated was something that's much more kind of basic, which is, do you have an obligation to stenographically report things that are untrue, that are distorted what seemed to be comfort food for a certain audience out there. And look, Chris Licht has run smack dab into this problem at CNN where we're too left-leaning. That wasn't true. CNN was not too left-leaning. It's like Stephen Colbert said, reality has a well-known liberal bias. They were reporting, and what they were not providing was comfort food to the right. Despite their efforts to put people like Rick Santorum on the air and do, to me, the whole argument is muddled.
Let me just give you an example. Since I've listened to NPR, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, their various programs, podcasted for, I'd say, 40 years, a long time. And here's one thing that just kept resonating with me. And I never wrote a story about it and thought about it. It'd be a throwaway story. But I think it actually is in some ways a revealing story. They occasionally, irregularly, but consistently, do a lot of stories about wine, about the wine business. Why? Why are you reporting on the wine business? Wine grapes in Napa, wine in France.
Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
I heard this consistently over time, and I thought, this is revealing in a weird way. It's revealing that their audience is interested in this particular thing. Does that make them a conservative or liberal? No, but it makes them culturally a certain way. It makes them culturally interested in whatever wine, and it becomes this cliche about Chardonnay sipping liberals. But nevertheless, that to me was a great baseline about what NPR is. It's what middle to upper middle class pretensions might be rather than a political thing. And I could not sustain the argument for this, but it was, you didn't report on the steel industry as much as you reported on the wine industry. And I thought that was just a telling aspect.
I'm so glad you went there, though, because I think this takes me down the road that I was thinking of, which is, this is the challenge that I think is presented to even major news organizations right now, which is they have a core business, which is news content. For the largest and most successful news organizations, that's not what makes money. The number one generator of web traffic, I'm about to cite statistics to an expert on the media. I can't believe I'm doing this. This is insane of me. So just tell me that I'm full of it when I get this wrong. My understanding is, I should say, that the number one generator of web traffic to the New York Times is Wirecutter. And number two is the crossword. And to me, that feels, if that's remotely correct, that feels on Truth Serum inside the Ox Sulzberger family. They have decided that there is a little bit of a compromise to be had here, which is, they're providing their version of NPR's wine content. This is what, you know, gets people in the door. It's part of the business enterprise of a full newspaper that reports on culture and movies and Wirecutter and what's the lowest cost place to get a tactical concealed gun shelf and stuff like that. And also, they provide the most important source of news in the world.
Sure.
And that compromise is okay to me. It's okay. Yeah.
It's not a compromise. It's called a newspaper. Back before the internet, why did people read the newspaper? Some read it for the sports section, some read it for the help wanted ad, some read it for the news. In fact, we didn't even really know why they were getting it. Katharine Graham, I remember making a speech, said, the Washington Post is a supermarket. You push your cart down the aisle. Wow. Over here is canned foods. Over here is the fresh vegetables. You don't want those, but you want that over there. It's a lot of choice. And what's the New York Times doing? Very smartly is replicating what a newspaper was on the internet. And their model, and the Washington Post as well, is to get subscribers. What are subscribers interested in? Well, they're interested in Wirecutter and Wordle and what's going on in the Mideast and what's going on with presidential politics. There's a whole lot of interest and a whole lot of people out there. And they want to appeal to every single one of them. And that's the strategy. And I'm not sure what the numbers are now. I still think news was the main subscription thing. But anyway, the things you are talking about, people have said the New York Times is now a cooking app with a newsroom attached to it, or it's a games app with a newsroom. But I'm not sure the New York Times should care that people say that. It's a great news organization that is not diminished by having cooking and games and wire cutter reviews. It's enhanced by it because people come for one thing and they stay for another thing. And that's how you build subscriptions. The New York Times is over 10 million subscriptions. Why? Because they offer all these different things to all kinds of people. And everybody else is chasing them and is a long way behind them in trying to catch up. One of the things said about the Washington Post is we missed our chance to buy Wordle. Who bought Wordle? The New York Times did. And it's been a huge success for them. And we lost our chance to buy fill in the blank because, again, this is how you build the building blocks of a news organization. It's not about just news. News is your core, but you got a lot of other things.
You got to get people in the door.
That's right.
And maybe this does bring me to, we teased it a few minutes ago. We should hit people with the way you close your article, which is this question. I'll just quote it to you. You write, "The precipitous decline in traffic to conservative publications raises a larger and possibly unanswerable question. Did these operations ever really hold the political and cultural clout that critics ascribe to them at their peak?" You're basically saying, does this really matter? And I'll give you an example. I have been focused a lot personally recently on PragerU, the it's not really a university YouTube channel that puts out snappy 5-minute videos from a very right-wing perspective. Things like the good news on climate change, where the whole point is, here's an earnest-looking PhD who used to be at the Georgia Institute of something or other, geosciences, and says, good news, climate change, not a big deal. All right, carry on. And these videos get median of about 500,000 views each. Seems like a big deal. They've been added to the curriculum in 3 states that have right-wing education commissioners. And so it certainly feels from my standpoint, wow, this is a big deal. But is it in your mind? Are these sites, is the Daily Caller, Gateway Pundit, Federalist, are they actually a big deal?
This is your PhD thesis to come. What is the...
You're supposing that I'm still young enough to pursue a PhD.
Somebody, sir, and somebody probably has already. What is the connection between what you consume in media and how you vote and how you act and what you think? It's a complicated question. I'm sorry to be so boring, but that's actually the truth of the matter is it's a very complicated question. So in this case, I wonder, are you preaching to the choir? In other words, I go to Breitbart because I love what Breitbart's attitude is and they always have the right take. I watch Fox News because Fox News gives me the thing that reinforces my own pre-existing belief. And I see that as a phenomenon has this reinforcing quality of living in your own silo and hearing the things that you want to hear over and over again, because that's what you already believe. Is it recruiting anybody? We've had a great polarization in American politics for a pretty long time. And I don't think you can separate the fragmentation of and the polarization of the media with the fragmentation and polarization of the electorate. I think they are related phenomenon. But exactly how this works, I think, is a very complicated dynamic. Back to Facebook. Facebook fed a lot of people, took them down the rabbit hole, and there they go off becoming right-wing people. People are influenced by media. To me, is it reinforcing or is it influential is never entirely clear. And the individual's reasons for voting the way they vote, that's you drill down on that, and it's a lot of things. What your media diet is can be a lot of things too. And do they reinforce or do they influence is one of those debates that political scientists and PhD students will have forever.
I have a hypothesis about this as we look toward closing out here. It's a hypothesis. It's not well put together. It's not ready for my thesis defense committee. I'll put it that way. I see 2 effects and they're both bad. One of them is I think that there is, and this is something Sasha and I talked about as part of our interview last week, and he's documented, there is a certain, beyond reinforcement, there's a spillover effect. There are real world effects of amplification that hit actual persuadable swing voters. You can have stories that emerge from the dross of the right-wing fantasy machine and ecosystem, and they provoke response. That's a lot of his focus, is how to not respond, right? They provoke response. They get attention from mainstream media organizations that give them legitimacy. So there are effects, and those are bad, which would suggest that there was an impact from sites like Gateway Pundit. But the other thing that I think is an effect, and I think it's insidious, and I'm not quite sure what it amounts to, is I worry about the fracturing, not for a kind of my Al-Qaeda analogy reason that it's just harder to track where all of this is coming from, but in the way that it degrades, look at a business model like WAPO, right? Look at a business model of even a somewhat, you pointed to Fox News. There is occasionally reasonable content on foxnews.com. And as you see more and more fracturing, what those individuals and those micro sites are subject to is the algorithm. And I've experienced this myself. I have this podcast. I work very hard to differentiate it from other podcasts by having it be really substantive, by diving deep with experts who know what the heck they're talking about. I also contribute to this YouTube channel, and we put content like this sometimes on the YouTube channel. It doesn't do as well as the more explosive, algorithmically optimized content. And that content is much more about dunking on Republicans. I have a video that's up from a week ago with 235,000 views as of this moment. And it's mostly talking about why Marjorie Taylor Greene has no allies left in the Republican Party and everyone hates her. Lo and behold, Democrats like to watch that video. I have lots of other videos with some of your journalistic colleagues out there doing deep dive analysis of really important issues that, let's just say, don't get the same kind of traffic. So this is my long-winded way of saying, I worry about the fact that as we see more and more fracturing, and as Gateway Pundit loses traffic to 1,000 Substacks and 1,000 podcasts, what are they all responding to? They're in a feedback loop, a crowdsourced feedback loop of what the algorithm will reward them for. And I think the algorithm will reward them for, I'm not criticizing my own videos. Like, I'm trying to make a serious point about Marjorie Taylor Greene and the Republican Party in this video. I want people to watch it. I think it's pretty good, but the incentives that are out there are pretty bad. And it leans toward content that is, I think, if anything, even worse than what you'd find on the Daily Caller. And that, I think, is ultimately a bad effect.
Yes, this has been true for a number of years. It didn't start last week. You can go back to the start of, say, Breitbart, 2012, maybe 2010, and they found that extreme content, Gateway Pundit might even be better. Half the stuff was speculative, half the stuff might not have been exactly true, etc. But it got the response, and people were able to click on it, and then it becomes that self-reinforcing kinds of thing. And as your example of your, what was it, a cabinet or whatever it was?
Right, the tactical concealment shack.
Yes, thank you. It becomes reinforcing. And you are, this is social media. You are gradually brought deeper and deeper down into the rabbit hole.
You want to get real meta on this? The company that sells the tactical concealment shelf is called Tactical Traps. And that's what you're describing, right?
Yeah.
It's a tactical
and it
trap.
Is a trap. And of course, this is what Congress has responded to in congressional hearings. And sometimes it leads to very, not just political behavior, but eating disorders and suicide and who knows what. The interrelationship between the rise of transgender interest and actual behavior, desire to change your gender, is in some ways a social media phenomenon. It was reinforced, especially during the pandemic, when people are isolated and there was a lot of stuff being fed to people. Now, is that, did it cause the rise in transgender identification? I don't know about cause. Again, there's this reinforcing quality. It presents it as an option and people explore it. So anyway, there's a million ways in which the algorithms end up reinforcing behaviors that might be good, might be bad, whatever, but they are self-reinforcing. This is the best I could do
right.
for you.
And you end up in a spiral that goes toward, I'm not sure it goes anywhere good. It feels very much like down the drain.
Which is why I just want to say is get out of the loop and go to places you don't really agree with or want to see, just so you will have other sources of information. It will help you understand what's true, what's not true, what's a fact and what's not a fact. Expand your mind as well as your browsing habits.
And support high quality media content.
Thank you.
All of the many times that I have been told on Twitter to stop subscribing to Washington Post and the New York Times, I wrote a whole article, absolutely, I hope justifiably, destroying the New York Times for completely screwing up their reporting early on in the war in Gaza. And I wrote a whole critique in Newsweek that got a lot of traffic, but I maintain my subscription to the New York Times. I maintain my subscription to WAPO, The Atlantic, which is where I came across your story.
This is another conversation we could have, but the New York Times gets disproportionately criticized for what it does, what other news organizations actually have done as well. But since the New York Times is held up as the standard of journalism,
right,
it gets everybody worked up. And the Washington
Post, the absolute worst, except for everything else.
And it's also one of the best.
And it's also exactly right. And I think that is what people can do. People can vote with their dollars and vote with their feet to the sources, including this podcast and the work of Paul Fahey, which I thoroughly endorse. And your article was fantastic. And thanks so much for being on Beyond Politics.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.